If you enjoy genres like slowcore, post-hardcore, noise rock, math rock, shoegaze, or anything like that, tune into Past Tense 9 p.m. Wednesdays on CFRC. It also airs 9 p.m. Mondays on luradio.ca and 9 p.m. Thursdays on cjlo.com.
August 23rd, Gales Game Day returns to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Yes! I love football!
Tune in at 2:45 p.m. for the Grad Club pregame show ahead of the scheduled 3 p.m. kickoff for the 100th game between your Queens Gales and the hated Western Mustangs.
What's happening? This is Kid Koala. You're listening to CFRC 101.9. Keep it locked.
That is Play With Records. Get your favorite records, put them on the machine, Play With Records.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Welcome to another episode of Blueprints of Disruption, a podcast that is dedicated to amplifying the work of grassroots movements and motivating people to take action themselves. This week's episode is a great example of that. Just moments ago, on July 29th, 2025, representatives from the Arms Embargo Now movement held a press conference in Ottawa to announce the findings of a report which contradicts everything the federal government has been saying about Canada's role in supplying arms to the genocidal occupation forces. You likely won't be all that surprised, but you will be enraged when you hear how much and how recently we've been sending lethal weaponry over, all while our politicians pretend to condemn the violent outcomes they create. It isn't just hypocrisy. This is outright lying, and it's just the tip of the iceberg. Rachel and Hanin are here to talk about exactly what's in the report, what it took to bring it to light, and what they plan on doing with this information. Well, more accurately, what you can do with this information. They make it clear that this is your report to run with. We've included plenty of links in the show notes to get you started. Most importantly, there's a link to register for a urgent movement meeting this week and other ways you can plug right into this campaign to secure an actual arms embargo. For now, sit and listen and then get organized. Good morning. Can you please introduce yourself, starting with Hanin, please?
Hi, Jessa. My name is Hanin. I'm from the Palestinian Youth Movement. And for those who don't know, the POIM is the independent grassroots group that's led by young Palestinians and Arab across the world, especially those living in exile due to the ongoing Israeli occupation and colonization. And just give a really, really quick background on what POIM does. We work to mobilize and empower Palestinian youth through community organizing, political education, leadership building, cultural work. So yeah, and in a few lines, this is who we are.
Hi, great to be back on this podcast. My name is Rachel Small. I'm the Canada lead with World Beyond War. We're a global grassroots org taking on the military-industrial complex, literally trying to abolish war here across so-called Canada. We work really in solidarity with people all around the world who are facing the blunt end of war, who are in Gaza facing Israeli machine guns, but also in Sudan, in Congo, in Ukraine. Our work over the past 21 months has been very focused on untangling the Canada-Israel arms trade. We recognized a real lack of information in terms of government transparency, but also in terms of other research to really trace Canada's role in arming Israel's genocide. And so that's been one of our key focuses over the past 2 years. I mean, and extending before that as well.
One of your key focuses. My chuckle was just, you already, the plate sounds so full. I mean, you started with, we're trying to stop all war, and it's, you know, plus, you know, here's how we're doing it. Both of your organizations have your hands full. We already know what's brought you together. Both your organizations have been on the show before, so I will link those ones that focused on what both of these organizations do, how they're made up, their origin stories and whatnot, because they are intriguing. However, I'm lucky actually to have them both in the studio to talk about the most recent report that they are putting out together. And I think folks are going to be shocked. I mean, I don't know how we can continue to be shocked, but when it comes to Canada being complicit in the genocide, it's a bit of a gray area, right? We're told one thing, we hear whispers of another, but you're here to kind of lay it straight. Can you maybe, let's just kind of get it out. Let's hear what you found out, and then we'll find out how you found all of this out and what we're going to do about it.
So essentially, the main goal of this report is actually to call out the discrepancies between what Canada has been saying publicly versus what's actually happening on the ground. You know, so the Canadian government clearly said that stopping military transfers to Israel, and an example is back in September 2024, then Foreign Minister Melanie Joly said that we will not have any form of arms or parts of arms sent to Gaza, period.
You can't forget the period.
Yeah, exactly. And what our researchers were able to find tells a different story of actually what's happening. So essentially, the report is going to be talking about military-related shipments that are still happening, still ongoing since October 2023 until this very last week.
I got only a little peek at some of...
There's a lot more, yes.
I imagine, you know, Rachel, you mentioned spending maybe thousands of hours on this collectively. And like I said, I've got a little tidbit and that enraged me. You know, I'm looking through my notes and it's things like 500,000 bullets. And I imagine the images that we've seen, like instantly in my mind, like I feel such this visceral responsibility, knowing that, and that's just a tidbit of what you've unveiled. You let Joly off the hook a little bit because she follows with, you know, definitely period, nothing. And I don't care how they're being sent and where they're being sent is irrelevant, you know, so no loopholes. She's going to shut it down. And they did anything but, yeah. So how many arms are we sending to the occupation forces?
Millions, actually. Millions and millions worth of arms that are being sent. And we were able to actually find... So in the report, we're going to be talking about two different methodologies of how we found these shipments. So the first one is going to be really around actual shipping records. Okay, so shipping receipts that show that military components are leaving Canadian ports, Canadian airports, bound for the Zionist entity. And actually, the majority of what we found is going to Elbit Systems, which is Israel's largest weapons manufacturer in Israel.
Because that's my first question, right? How do you get receipts, right? Yeah. Like, you're talking really receipts.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically just shipping records that were made available to our researchers. So this is where we've been able to gather these receipts. So the second methodology is really about information that we found online on the Israeli Tax Authority website, which essentially, it's like a government website that deals with custom taxes, imports, exports. So basically, I guess we can compare it to Canada Revenue Agency. So it's part of the Israeli Minister of Finance. And one of its jobs is to track records, everything that enters the country, including military goods. So we've been able to go on the website and actually extract everything leaving from Canada to Israel from 2023 to 2025. And one of the major highlights that we've been able to gather is that since August alone, August 2023, Canada has shipped over 10 million bullets to Israel. And if we're talking about purely 2025, we have nearly 500,000 bullets sent. And just to, you know, make it even crazier is that in April alone, just this April 2025, we've sent 175,000 worth of bullets to the Zionist entity. So those are all public information that we've been able to, you know, anyone can go on the website, extract the information, and you can see clearly that these are military goods. And the way we're able to prove that these are military goods is because they're all classified with a HS code, which is a harmonized system code. And this is also a classification that Canada uses as well. So in the report, you're going to see like, okay, 93 is going to be weapons, bombs, grenades, for example. And as you go into details, it'll be more specific to what the actual shipment is. So we've been able to track a few of them that are literally bullets being sent.
How did they ever think they would get away with such public-facing statements? You mentioned Jolie, but Carney repeatedly also has said absolutely not. I mean, bullets are weapons, right? Like, there's, you know, components, that whole argument. Rachel, you were on before and talked about how they tried to walk around the idea that it was just like components for drones and that doesn't make us so bad, and, you know, without all the other parts, you know, everyone else is doing it, they'd have to put it together. But these are bullets, and you've been able to find the information with relatively limited resources. Why isn't the Canadian media picked up on this themselves, considering this has been a topic of discussion? Those politicians have been pushed many times. I'm mad. I can hear my voice cracking. Many times on whether or not we are still sending, right? They have heckled protesters who have disrupted events, yelling over them, we have an embargo, you know, just placating the liberals in Canada. I mean, liberal voters, they're just trying to get them to forget about it, right? Like, just forget about it. Don't worry, we stopped anything that we're responsible for. Any theories here on how they thought they would hide this? And I guess that's tied into my, like, why isn't the media picking up on this? Why did you folks have to dig this up?
Honestly, I don't know if they know that this is actually, like, if the Israeli tax authority data actually has this type of information, to be quite honest. So that's my personal opinion on that matter.
They're going to be surprised.
Yeah, because honestly, we went through it, me and Rachel, it's not the easiest data to go through. You know, it's not just, you know, you go on a page and it's all beautifully laid out for you. So it's you're still doing some digging and finding that data on the website. So I just don't think it's very publicized. And people just, I guess, wouldn't expect it to be so public, right? I mean, we also were surprised to even be able to get our hands on this kind of data.
I mean, yeah, so the Israeli import data is publicly available, but what's publicly available is like literally millions of lines of spreadsheet data documenting all the exports to all the imports to Israel from all countries around the world of every product, from like bananas to screws to bombs to toys. So it's an enormous amount of work to parse through that data and find anything meaningful, and especially to pull out specifically military exports from Canada to Israel, which are not conveniently labeled like, hey, these are the military exports you're looking for.
It'll color code it for you.
No, and it's in Hebrew. So the Israeli, a lot of it is in Hebrew. So a lot of the Israeli data is publicly available data, but data that takes hundreds of hours of parsing through to find this information. But I think broader what we're talking here that this data is showing, to speak kind of to your question, Jessa, is that like, since October 2023, like as Israel's genocide became more obvious, as movement pressure built, as pressure built between with lawsuits, with international legal mechanisms, even within Parliament, the Canadian government really just began to like systematically obfuscate, misrepresent, and sometimes fully lie about the nature of Canada's arms trade relationship with Israel, right? And that, like you said, has looked like different things every month. It has been a new thing from them every month. They've tried to downplay like the lethality of these goods, or like you're saying, Jessa, like, oh, these are just components, as though like the part of a fighter jet that bombs people is like not lethal, only the entire jet as a whole is lethal. Like it was kind of obviously nonsense, but that was one angle. Another angle is that they made huge hay out of their announcement that we have paused issuing any new export permits to Israel. They said this over and over and over.
They passed a bill. Am I crazy?
A motion, a non-binding motion, was passed by Parliament. And they said they would respect it. And then they sort of made this big deal announcement. We're not issuing any new export permits to Israel, which I should say was a significant thing to do, made the Israeli government extremely mad, made international headlines around the world. It was an important step we forced them to do, and it's good that they stopped issuing any new permits. But what they conveniently failed to mention is that they had just approved hundreds of new permits in the first 3 months of the genocide, right before their January pause in December, November, October. They were busy pushing through tons of approvals. And those permits that had already been approved, they didn't cancel those, right? So what this report really shows is, hey, those permits that we've been calling you out on for over a year that you didn't cancel before your big pause, we now see what those permits allowed for. And they allowed for just this constant shipment of military goods unending up to this week from Canada to Israel. And it is everything from fighter jet parts, communications tools, electronic warfare systems, to ammunition and cartridges and bullets. It's extremely damning data that's in this report. And I mean, it really shows the lengths the Canadian government went to conceal Canada's role in Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. And really, you can pick any government statement, I think, about the arms exports to Israel over the past 21 months, and I think this report would debunk it. Even for me, who was one of the folks who founded the Arms Embargo Now campaign a year ago and has been coordinating it since, who knows that the Canadian government has been lying about these arms exports, and we've been sharing with the public and with our communities, like, hey, they're not telling the truth about it. Even for me, this report was shocking. I did not expect to see more than nearly 500,000 bullets exported, bullets from Canada to Israel since October 2023. I did not expect to see F-35 parts going directly from Canada to Israel. We thought they were all going via the U.S. And I should really point out that the data in this report is a snapshot. We make no claims that we caught all the shipments. We know we didn't. We know that what we caught was a snapshot. We caught, like Hanin said, 47 detailed shipping records. So those are like commercial shipping records that say X package left this factory on this date and went to not just Israel, like went to this Elbit facility in Tel Aviv on this date. So we've got 47 of those really detailed receipts. There are hundreds of shipments. We only got 47. So we will never say this is the full picture. But what this snapshot shows is damning and shows that the Canadian government's been lying.
Makes you wonder what else we don't know, right? You know about the loopholes to the U.S. or other states that eventually end up in Israel. You know you've probably missed some line items amongst these millions of records. And then there's like, what don't we know? What doesn't have a tax trail? Do you think the Canadian military is aiding the Israeli army in a way that they're not being forthright about? Are all of these shipments commercial shipments, meaning going through commercial routes?
So that's a really, really good question. Is that I think we've been able to identify nearly 100 international flights between those 47 shipments that we found. And about 64, I believe, about 60 of them are commercially passenger air flights. So that means that military cargo was literally loaded beneath every traveler, under families, under students, under people just going trying to get from one place to another, you know. So, and honestly, that really makes me sick, because it just shows how invisible this kind of violence, you know, can be. It's hidden in plain sight. So, yeah, to answer your question, most of them are commercial aircraft. Airline, sorry.
So just to underline that point, like, one shipment that we found shows F-35 fighter jet parts flying on an Air Canada flight from Halifax to Toronto and then Toronto to Frankfurt. So these are flights with, like, people in Canada getting on a plane to fly to Germany. And turns out under their seats were literal parts of F-35 fighter jets going directly to Elbit in Israel. I think it speaks for itself.
It's invisible, but it's also so normalized in that way. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just part of, like, the mail, right? Yeah. Like, it's just part of regular everyday business in Canada. Mm-hmm. Is shipping arms, yeah, to an illegal occupation.
I do want to answer your question about the military connections, though, because I think that's a really important question. So, I mean, there's no doubt that, I mean, obviously, the relationship between Canada and Israel is very different from the relationship between U.S. and Israel. So unlike the U.S., where in addition to selling mountains of weapons to Israel, the U.S. military is also just constantly donating, for lack of a, I mean, there's many words they use. Military aid is, like, literally just donating their equipment and their military technology and supplies.
So generous.
To Israel. To the best of our knowledge, Canada is not doing that, though they have been doing that to Ukraine. And I think the reason Canada is not doing that is because of the pressure from our movements, which is not to say that what they have been doing is not bad, but truly, I think it could be much worse. And I think it's a testament to our organizing of many, frankly, hundreds of thousands of people across the country, that has stopped them from taking a more blatantly active role in arming Israel. And the Canadian government has a number of times said, oh, we're not sending weapons to Israel. They're from Canadian companies, which I don't think is an excuse that has landed with anybody at all. But what they're referring to is that the Canadian government is not gifting weapons to Israel. They're just selling Canadian weapons to Israel. That said, there are other types of partnerships that are a real problem.
And don't worry, we're making a profit.
Yeah. But there's other types of partnerships that are a real problem and that we don't know enough about. Like Canada, for example, has the Canada-Israel Strategic Partnership, which they have not suspended, and which includes a commitment to share military intelligence, for military cooperation and work together, for joint training exercises, for intelligence coordination. Like, that's a partnership that the Canadian military still has with the Israeli military. We also have seen Israeli weapons and technology systems being tested on Canadian bases, as in Israeli weapons companies have been, like, welcomed into these training sessions on Canadian bases where, like, new technology gets to be tried out by the military. So there's a whole bunch of levels of partnership between the Canadian military and the Israeli military beyond just the export of weapons. But this is a really big piece.
It's huge. It's huge. And it's, you keep mentioning, like, it seems heinous to think of it operating like that, like a business, but that's exactly what it is, right?
Yeah.
It is just a business that, well, because when we're trying to, well, there's lots of reasons Canada is propping up a genocide with our own history and all the roles that we play, but yeah, it's just, it's also a business. There's profits to be made, and cutting off those profits is sometimes one of the hardest things to do. However, you know the ports and the airports these shipments are leaving from now. That's always handy. We're always looking for pressure points. A lot of those workers in those areas tend to be in unions, loading aircraft and preparing the ports for, you know, shipments and whatnot. So I think what else can we do with this information, as well as, you know, shaming the politicians? What are you going to do with this report?
So we do have, a rollout plan. We haven't touched, well, I mean, I think we're working on labor on the side. Maybe Rachel, like, you can talk more about that. But we do, you know, plan on having press conference. We're going to have town halls. We'll have, you know, the direct actions. And all of that will come right after the report, so that the community will be able to do something. You know, they won't just be, you know, angry in their own homes, but they'll be able to actually go out in the streets and protest. So one of the, you know, the actions that we would want to take is maybe mobilizing at General Dynamics, because in those 47 shipments that we're talking about, there are three shipments that went out, one in September 2024, one in May 2025, and one just, you know, less than a week ago. And those are all shipments of cartridges that, you know, we have bills of ladings for cartridges leaving General Dynamics from Repentigny going directly to the Zionist state. So this, I think, is going to cause outrage for sure.
I'm mad. Sure. Yeah. No. What are the other, you mentioned General Dynamics. Sometimes people are really shocked to learn. I know when we did Rachel's episode, we included like this kind of interactive map that you had put together. People are shocked that some of these companies are right next to them in smaller communities sometimes, or you know, some of these ports are nearer to them than they think. Like, everything seems so out of reach for us when we're watching it through the screen. But then you find out, you know, weapons manufacturer is actually just a 30-minute drive from you. I mean, there's lots of people can do with that information. But what are the other companies that were prominent in the receipts?
Can I just first say, for those listening to this podcast right away, this Thursday, July 31st, we're holding a big urgent movement briefing. And that is where we'll be sharing this report in detail with our movements, with our people, and going through what it means, and also showing these maps that show where are the shipments that we identified coming from, but also what is the broader web look like of companies that we know across Canada are arming Israel. We've got some maps of the routes that are being taken on these flights as well, so that will be really a chance for people across the country to dig in at the bigger picture, but also locally. Like, what does this complicity look like? Like you said, right in my backyard. And on that call, we'll also be emphasizing what I said earlier, which is, look, these 47 specific shipments that we found, unfortunately, this is not the picture of all the complicit companies. These are the ones we happened to spot, and they include some major companies like General Dynamics, like CAE, like Pratt & Whitney, and they include some local, like mom-and-pop electrical shops in the Greater Toronto area that, frankly, a majority of their business is probably not to do with the weapons industry, but here they are exporting some key components to Elbit Systems. But these 47 shipments, again, just a snapshot, and they don't show the full picture that we've uncovered in other ways of what are all the other companies in Canada that we know are arming Israel and that we know are exporting weapons, even if we didn't manage to grab the literal shipping receipt on a particular a day. But I'll let Hanin jump in on, yeah, some of the other kind of companies that are featured here.
Yeah, so we've named seven major cities that are shipping these military components. So we have Montreal, we have Halifax, Calgary, Vancouver, the GTA, Waterloo, and Ottawa. And, you know, Rachel mentioned a few of them, like CAE, there's Tilia, there's Nexia, there's Intercorp. You have the little companies that she was talking about, like AM Rubber and Foam Gaskets. So it's like little components that are, you know, are being sent. But honestly, whatever it may be, whether it's a sheet or insulation or whatever it is, it's still part of, you know, the broader military, maybe jets, you know, or drones. So every little detail is, you know, is a Canadian company supporting the ongoing genocide in Gaza. But yeah, so even CMC, Pratt & Whitney, those are pretty huge. So there's a lot of companies that were named actually in those 47 shipments. You're going to be able to see the companies, where it's coming from, where it's going to in Israel. And like we've said before, the majority of them are going to go to Elbit System. So this is a clear indicator that these are going to, you know, the largest weapons manufacturer in Israel. You're going to see when they're leaving exactly, when they're arriving, what airlines, the airline flights. So it's going to be extremely detailed and very, very hard for, you know, the government to deny any of this, because one of the columns that you're going to see in those tables is the goods description. So you're going to see, you know, military aircraft, you're going to see antennas, sensors, you know, all like components that are, you know, what makes these, for example, these jets operate, you know, and take off safely and be able to target, to be able to have, you know, those sensors. So, yeah, we're going to be doing a very deep dive into, you know, what these components are and how they're being used. So we mentioned a study case around the F-35. And for those who don't know, but I think the majority of people know, but since October 2023, Israel has been carrying out what we can call genocide from the sky, you know? So at the center of this campaign is the F-35 fighter jet, which can carry over, you know, I think it was nine tons of bombs, which is enough to, like, it's enough firepower to wipe out entire neighborhoods. And that's what they've been doing, you know, wiping out neighborhoods, refugee camps, homes, hospitals, and even so-called safe zone. So in that section of the case study, we're going to talk about how Canadian companies are, you know, deeply tied to this weapons of mass destruction, which was the F-35. And even, you know, when you go on Lockheed Martin's website, they boast about the fact that like $2.3 million worth of Canadian made parts are put into these fighter jets. And amongst these companies, we're going to be naming, you know, Nexia Canada, which are shipping a device which is called a modular product tester. And essentially what it is that it helps test all electrical components of the system of the F-35. So that way it's clear for action. So in other words, it makes sure that every bomb dropped and missile strike goes as planned. So that's one of the companies that we're naming in the case study and that we have, you know, shipping data on. Another one is going to be CMIC Electronics, which send what we call Doppler navigation sensors. And this essentially gives the jet ultra precise, you know, guidance, which is, you know, the cruel irony is that despite being called precision, this has killed over, you know, 60,000 Palestinians since October 2023. And then lastly, we're going to talk about Celia in more depth because Celia has contracts with Elbit in order to build these components and parts that are actually going on the F-35's body. So essentially without these, the jet can't fly off the ground. So it just shows how every single, you know, how Canadian companies are complicit, and we're choosing three amongst the ones that have shipped you know, weapon components to Israel.
I would imagine some of the smaller companies might be easier to lean on as well. They wouldn't like this kind of exposure for selling, you know, even these tiny non-lethal components that you've laid out are actually quite lethal in themselves. But it gives me hope to hear that sometimes these little bits have huge implications, meaning you don't necessarily have to stop the whole plane, everyone doing their part bit by bit, you know, stop making it even more difficult to fly each and every run, makes a difference, right? Because you're not, this isn't isolated to Canada. There are activists in all the Western nations kind of putting these pressures on. We've seen Palestinian action in the UK damage facilities and successfully damage drones there, you know, doing their bit by bit. But yeah, no, hearing that sometimes it is the mom and pop, I go, well, surely even like a successful TikTok campaign would perhaps shut some of these folks down or at least get them to change the way that they do business. I mean, it's also maddening, though, to think that the big guys, I don't know, you're kind of like, yeah, evil. But how small folks couldn't turn down a little bit of profit to not fund a genocide, I don't think I could understand. I mean, I don't understand the other guys anyway, but I thought it would be a deterrent, even just with political distaste. You know, forget maybe you don't have morals, you don't care about people on the other side of the earth for whatever reason, but why would you step into this madness and fund this if you weren't 100% sure that you weren't contributing to a genocide? I mean, I had a restaurant down the street had Israeli couscous on their takeout menu, and I was like, next. Like, no. Like, you don't have to list that in this day and age. Like, are you kidding me? That's a seasonal menu. I will never go there again. Like, what are you doing? How can you not take, like, the smallest little stand at this point? But, you know, that's them. Our real anger really should be the Canadian government, right? They're supposed to be mediating this unhinged capitalism, but we elected a banker. But that banker just said, I mean, this is as far as they've really gone, I think, in language, calling Israel's actions, he means the denial of aid, not the bombing or the F-35s, a violation of international law. So already they have obligations to not be sending weapons to Israel, right? Because there've been ruling after ruling. They are actively contributing to something they're obligated to stop. But now they themselves are calling what Israel's doing a violation of international law. And even if we're just talking about cartridges and bullets, surely that's part of that denial.
Yeah, can I jump in, though, as well on those other really two key pressure points that you mentioned earlier that we didn't get to talk about? So one was labor and unions, and I'd love to just jump in on that because I think it's a really key point. So as you mentioned, yeah, now that we have some specific information about some of the factories that have been doing, from which some of these shipments are leaving to Israel, and also the methods of transport, it does highlight the role of workers, most of which are not unionized, some of which are. And I mean, one thing that's been really that I've really enjoyed about working on the Arms Embargo Now campaign is that a number of the biggest unions in the country are signatories and have been allies in this, and are demanding an arms embargo, mostly public sector unions, although interestingly, including CAPE, which unionizes the workers who approve the weapons permits or work on the weapons permits.
Federal workers, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. But also, you know, there's a whole bunch of unions that are part of it. But notably, I mean, a bunch of these factories are Unifor factories, are Unifor shops, where the weapons identified, the shipments in this report were identified. And I mean, Unifor just, I think it was a month ago, finally put out, frankly, a really powerful statement demanding an arms embargo on Israel. So I see this as a really important opportunity for Unifor to step up and to continue to step up and say, look, we called for an arms embargo a month ago. Now we see that some of our Unifor shops are directly implicated in some of these shipments. And we as workers have real power here to stop these shipments, to take a stand. I see it as a real opportunity for Unifor in that case to match its strong words with real action on the ground. But frankly, also, as you mentioned, there are workers across the transportation lines. This report does reveal, as Hanin mentioned, many, many, many commercial flights on many different airlines leaving all the main airports in the country. So there's the airport workers, the airline workers, but then also there's shipments by rail on CN Rail, leaving out of the port in Halifax. So these are other spaces of intervention for workers. And of course, many on trucks going on Canadian highways. So I think there are like a lot of points of intervention, which I'm excited about. But then the other thing is once these flights leave Canada, many of them are being transshipped, like our transshipment, that's what's called, through Europe and through other cities around the world. But I mentioned Europe specifically because the EU has quite strict requirements on what needs to be declared if you're shipping weapons through European airports, or in fact, even flying it over EU airspace. And I was just speaking last week with an activist from Belgium where just a couple weeks ago, they had an incredible court victory, where a regional court declared that no weapons to Israel could go through a port in Belgium. And what they didn't have at the time, those activists, is evidence that weapons were also going through Belgian airports. So what they're hoping is that this is just kind of one offshoot from this report, but they're hoping that the evidence we've shown that there's weapons that fly through the airport in Liège, that that will be what they need to be able to get a ban on these weapons also flying through Belgian airports. So we really, I mean, the weapons industry and the flow of weapons is obviously global and obviously defies any of the border restrictions that any government is talking about putting in. Like, these weapons fly effortlessly across borders, but so do our movements, right? And we are, as you mentioned, connected to activists all over the world. And we don't stop feeling responsible for these weapons the second they leave Canadian airspace, right? And we just kind of pass I don't want to say the responsibility, but we pass kind of the load of organizing against these weapons onto our friends in other countries when they go there, and they're ready to pick that up and to see what they can do to stop these shipments too.
Just think of it, you've given your Belgian comrades points of intervention that they may have been lacking. You know, they got a victory, they need another goal. Yeah, they're looking for other ways to contribute. So, let it not be a burden to them, but let them roll with this information. And I imagine you're hoping a lot of folks are going to pick up with this information. I'll include links to the Urgent Movement briefing on Thursday, so folks will have plenty of time to listen to this, but then really get the meat and potatoes from all the work Hanin have done. Just describing the database kind of gave me a headache, trying to think of going through all of that information. And I imagine maybe other activists in other countries are looking at what you've done. I had a question there, but I answered or don't answer it. Did you give Unifor a heads up?
Yeah, we are in communication with the unions, especially the ones that have been kind of calling for an arms embargo. And yeah, we are in communication with them about this report. And we hope that they will be able to use this information and mobilize their membership and go through their processes to take real action based on it. I obviously can't speak to what they will do. But yeah, we would consider all of these workers and these unions allies in this struggle. And we each have our lane where we can take action on this. And I think workers are a key one. And I should also, of course, give a shout out to Labor for Palestine, which has been doing such amazing work organizing with unions and with labor over the last 21 months, especially. And they're a key part of this report as well.
Hanin, what did you learn putting this report together, other than, you know, the horrors you're going to spell out for folks and the stuff that we're going to get mad about? But I mean, like, talking to other activists who sometimes have to do this kind of tedious long-term work when everything seems so urgent, right? This took a long time. At some point, you wanted to just tell everybody every little bit you found. But you folks sat hours and hours and months and held on to this and crafted something, a real tool for a lot of people to use. Do you have any lessons you can share with us?
Listen, it really did take a lot of time. It took a lot of energy. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, for the longest time, you know, I think we've all felt very hopeless, you know, like what can we do? So this, honestly, to me, putting all this energy, I felt it, but I can say that every single second of it was worth it, because this is the least that we can do during, you know, these, you know, what's happening in Gaza. It's, I don't know, lessons. I think what I learned is that if we push hard enough, the information is out there. And I'm really excited to keep working on more things coming, because this is not going to be the end of it, you know, unfortunately. So I want to keep this going. We want to keep this going as a team. And we want to be able to, if the government says another, you know, statement, we want to be able to keep, we want to make sure that this is the truth. You know what I mean? So in the report, Rachel is going to talk about all of the lies and, you know, chronologically, and every single time we show them something, they come up with another lie to try to hide what we've, you know what I mean? So I just want to make sure that we reach a point where this is no longer happening. And until, you know, this happens, you know, we don't want to stop what we're doing.
Well, you do eventually, right? I mean, one day we can rest.
One day, yes. Hopefully.
But I think, like Hanin alluded to, further research, and I think it's really important to highlight, like, all of the research and the revelations in this report is just about direct military exports from Canada to Israel, when we know that's only one of kind of three big parts of an arms embargo, right? Like, there's these direct exports, and that's all this report touches on. But then, like you also alluded to earlier, Jessa, there's the whole second pie of the indirect exports, the weapons Canada sells to the U.S., and then the U.S. either gifts or sells up to Israel. This report doesn't even dig into that, but we have plans on that. And then the third whole piece that this report doesn't touch on is all the weapons Canada is buying from Israel. So we're showing, hey, look at all these things Canada is selling to Elbit. We haven't even touched on yet, what is Canada buying from Elbit? Like, how are we flowing Canadian, in this case, taxpayer dollars, by Canadian military, but also Canadian police forces buying tons of military equipment from Israel? This doesn't even get into those two pieces. So there's lots more to uncover. But I mean, one thing I want to say, though, about this research and this report is that I think it is like a really shocking amount of information about these exports. But on its own, this information is not going to change what the Canadian government does. What we need this report to do is to generate a political crisis for the Canadian government. And that's our purpose as movement organizations. Like POAM and World Beyond War, we're not like research think tanks, right? Like, if we're putting these hours into a report, it's because we need it to change Canada's material support of Israel's genocide. And the only way that's going to happen with this report is if our movements take it up. Like, I really want to speak to, yeah, again, like, it's more than 450 organizations at this point that have endorsed the Arms Embargo Now campaign. And I know that there's like hundreds of thousands of people across the country who are waiting for these updates. This is your report, right? This belongs to all of those people. And it is only going to create an arms embargo. It's only going to actually stop the flow of weapons if everyone takes this up and uses the info in it to hold the Canadian government's feet to the fire. And we know that kind of pressure can force them to act. But the report on its own, unfortunately, the truth, the information, like, we have decades of social movement history to know that the truth on its own doesn't create change. It's when people mobilize the truth to put real pressure on the government that change happens. So I hope that everyone will consider this their report and will run with it, whether that's confronting their local MPs, whether that's, as Hanin mentioned, perhaps showing up at some of their local weapons factories. And we'll have lots of ideas of what people can do with this report on Thursday's call. And if anyone's listening to this podcast and Thursday's call has passed, all of the info is at armsembargonow.ca/report. So the report is there. The information on the urgent movement briefing is there. And if the briefing has already happened, the recording will also be there.
I can only imagine you have some suggested actions. I would like to see what didn't make the final cut. You know, things we could do, things we want to do, things we're legally allowed to do, Yeah, I look forward to seeing the report in its entirety. I will link as much information as you release it. We will feed it into the show notes for folks just looking to click and end up at World Beyond War's website or Palestinian Youth Movement. I usually steer folks towards your Instagram. It's full of actions constantly happening right across the country. Do you folks have any parting words?
I would say, I hope that everyone, you know, feels as infuriated as we do, and that, you know, people reach out. I think we're also going to have an email on the Arms Embargo website. So if they have any questions, anything like that, we'll answer any question that it may be. And, you know, to support, share, talk about it, because this is what's going to really make a difference, like Rachel said.
It would be nice if everyone had that in their pocket, you know, for when they tried to that line, we don't sell arms, and everyone just knew in the back of their head, no, we know you do, you know, like, that just doesn't fly anymore. They're going to have to either retool their argument or stop.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, we will do our best to amplify this and all the work that you do. And I very much appreciate all the work that you do and your comrades behind you.
Thank you so much.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us.
Mimi Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Two leading Israeli human rights groups, B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights Israel, have accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. Yuli Novak, the executive director of B'Tselem, spoke in Jerusalem Monday.
The report we are publishing today is one we never imagined we would have to write. But in recent months, we have been witnessing a reality that has left us no choice but to acknowledge the truth. Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We're joined right now by Sadiq Mikhaeli, International Outreach Director for the Israeli group B'Tselem. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain your findings at this point.
Thank you, Amy. Yes, the report we issued yesterday essentially finds that Israel's policies in the Gaza Strip, their catastrophic consequences, together with statements by senior Israelis, together with the documentation of what these statements led to, points us to the unequivocal conclusion that Israel is taking a systematic, organized action to destroy Palestinian society in Gaza. And this is the textbook definition of genocide. The report also says that this action by Israel is a reflection of a genocidal regime. And therefore, there is also a grave risk that given certain circumstances, the genocide, Israel's actions will spread to other areas where Palestinians live under Israel's control.
This isn't the first time B'Tselem has been the first Israeli group to speak out. In 2021, you called Israel an apartheid regime. Lay out your findings, what you document, what you call the clear intentional attack on civilians in order to destroy a group.
Yes. So, first of all, we rely both on witness testimonies collected by our field researchers in Gaza who have been evacuated but continue to collect information and personal accounts from Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. But we also rely on credible information from many other sources. So this is the body of information. We then looked at what Israeli policymakers said, and we in fact provided a very long list of these statements, and essentially there is no there's nothing that has happened that wasn't stated openly by Israeli policymakers. The catastrophic, the horrific consequences of this that we list in our report, aside from the huge, massive killing of civilians, you discussed it earlier in the program, reaching up to at least 60,000 people, of them tens of thousands of women and children. There is also the mass starvation now, as a matter of policy by Israel, of 2 million Gazans. There is the destruction, the razing of entire cities. There is a destruction of everything that is necessary to maintain human life. This is what we see in Gaza, and none of it was a secret. It's been known for months. This has been going on for 22 months. Israeli policies have been clear. Yet, this has not led to a concerted, to effective international action to stop this. And one of the things we say in the report, and one of the things we called for together with our colleagues from Physicians for Human Rights Israel yesterday, is for the international community as well as Israelis to take all action in the framework of international law to get this to stop, to get this to end. Now, yes, B'Tselem is an Israeli organization. We are based in Israel, and we're also made up of Israelis and Palestinians. And I think one of the important novelties or the things that we say in this report that breaks new ground is not just a discussion of what's happening on the ground right now in Gaza, but the discussion of the root causes of this Israeli genocide. And we call the report our genocide. We look at the history, and we also look at this horrific, horrendous trigger of October 7th. The Hamas atrocities were perpetrated against Israeli civilians and have led to this terrible trauma that Israelis feel were then exploited cynically by our government in order to push policies that the government and very powerful members of our government have been trying to promote even before, as I said, this massacre of October 7th. So the report essentially looks at not just the reality on the ground right now, but looks at why we have been, what made it possible for us to reach this horrendous stage where Israel is perpetrating genocide, where the international community is not stopping this, where Israelis, the majority of Israelis, are either silent or supportive of this genocide, and what can we say and do as people inside Israel, both Israelis and Palestinians who are operating within Israeli civil society, in order to stop it now.
As we reported in headlines just yesterday on Monday in the occupied West Bank, an Israeli settler shot and killed a Palestinian activist and teacher, 31-year-old Olda Mohammed Hadaleen, who played a key role in the production of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land. Residents identified his killer as Yinon Levy, an Israeli settler who was sanctioned by the Biden administration. The Trump administration lifted those sanctions. There's videos showing him firing a gun. Talk about the significance of this and the violence in the West Bank as well. We just have 30 seconds.
Yes, absolutely. I think, first of all, so I think this is just a clear example of how exposed Palestinian lives are under Israeli occupation and apartheid, both in the West Bank and certainly in Gaza. The lack of any consequences, we expect Yinon Levy to not have to pay a significant price, is the result of policy, and it's also the result of international inaction. And it is so symbolic that the Trump administration essentially lifted the sanctions, the very meager sanctions that were imposed by the Biden administration on this individual, but it's an entire system of impunity and support for this settler terror that has been responsible, and that we see as responsible, for the killing of dear Ode Hadaleen, who was really a friend to us all. Anyone who was active in the Masafer Yatta area knew Ode, stayed with him, spent time with him, and listened to him.
If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.